Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. This summer, the Russian government released an update to its national security strategy, the first since that document was officially released in 2015. The latest version of Russia's grand strategic plan is significant for a lot of reasons, but in particular for its focus on information warfare. It stresses the need to guard Russian citizens against foreign subversion and dwells in particular on the imperative of developing what it calls a quote-unquote safe information space to protect Russian society and its citizens from destructive information and its psychological impact. It reads, quote, destructive forces abroad and within the country are making attempts to use objective socioeconomic difficulties in the Russian Federation in order to stimulate negative social processes, exacerbate inter-ethnic and interfaith conflicts, and manipulate in the information sphere. In response, the document lays out that Russia needs to create a safe environment for the circulation of reliable information at home, and to develop a system for forecasting, identifying, and preventing threats to the information security of the Russian Federation and identifying their sources. In the last couple of episodes of Disinformation Wars, we have focused on the ways in which Russia has used information warfare as part of its foreign policy arsenal against the West. But what's the larger strategy behind those efforts? What are Russian leaders trying to accomplish? And what's the view from Moscow in informational terms? To get the answers to those questions, I turn to Andrei Soldatov. Andrei is a renowned Russian investigative journalist, now based in London. He's the co-founder and editor of the news website Agentura.ru. He is also, with Irina Borogan, the author of a number of best-selling books about Russian politics and society, including 2015's The Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries. Andrei, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Thank you for having me, Ilan.
Here in the US, we tend to think about Russian disinformation as a new phenomenon because most of us have become aware of it only recently, and then mostly in connection with the 2016 election. But as you lay out in your book, The Red Web, disinformation and propaganda were essential tools for the USSR and for the KGB throughout the decades of the Cold War. Can you talk a little bit about that? What were the objectives back then? And what was the Kremlin attempting to achieve?
Well, the big problem for the KGB was public opinion in the West. And they saw the problem with the United States, obviously, but also they saw some opportunities. They believed that using some interesting methods, mostly used by the KGB, they can split allies, they can restart some confusion between Western Europe and the United States. For instance, if you talk about nuclear proliferation and military bases of the United States in the UK or in Europe, and you can ask all these questions about whether it was actually justifiable to have all these soldiers and these military bases in the Western Europe, that actually was exploited by the KGB, and it was actually quite successful. Lots of people asked themselves these questions, and lots of people got really confused.
Okay, so let's fast forward into the post-Cold War era. How did those objectives change with the collapse of the USSR? Did the quote-unquote new Russia see the internet as an opportunity or as a threat or as both?
Well, I would say that despite the end of the Cold War, this topic of information warfare and disinformation surprisingly became even more important and crucial, because now it was not about conducting some operations abroad to achieve some strategic or tactical goals. It was about survival of the KGB. And in our of our books, The Compatriots, we describe an operation run by the Russian Foreign Intelligence Agency. And back then it was one of the departments of the KGB. And by the late 1980s, we understood that they could face the fate of Stasi. So we needed to do something. And they came up with the idea to launch a disinformation operation, but this time to target not only the West, but also people in the country, in Russia. And they launched this operation. It was extremely, extremely successful. They changed public opinion in the country and abroad about the Russian Foreign Intelligence Agency. They presented this agency as the most liberal part of the KGB, and that helped them to survive. And after that, they used these tactics many times. But with the internet, of course, the picture became even more complicated, mostly because of the Chechen war in the mid-1990s. The problem was that Russian army was actually losing this war, and they needed to blame somebody from outside why they were losing the war. Because we still had, back when in the 1990s, liberal media, new Russian liberal media, well, it was an easy target. So you can say Russian soldiers were good, everything went well, but foreign journalists and Russian journalists who might be influenced or paid or corrupted by the West, they are to blame because they are undermining our war effort. And that's exactly what we were starting telling to the Russian public. And again, it went quite successful.
I want to pull on that thread a little bit about the inward-facing propaganda that the Russian government is engaging in. We'll get to that in a second. But let me ask you this question first. You've described Russia's current efforts to control the internet as a quote-unquote monumental battle to shape information and its distribution to global publics, not only to the Russian people themselves, but is this a battle that Moscow is winning, do you think? And what are the tools that the Kremlin is employing to achieve this?
You know, that when we were writing our book in 2014, 2015, I believed that this battle, well, I would say that the Kremlin was losing this battle for many reasons, and historically and technically, that was quite obvious. They had problems catching up with the development of new technologies. They were not extremely competent online, and even trolls they used and employed against the Russian opposition and abroad were not extremely competent, easy to expose and all that. But after 2016, I think the situation changed dramatically. And I think that we are missing this, actually, and I'm really worried about it. And it's about many things, and one of them is very, I would say, ideological. Before 2016, there was a very clear divide, a border, if you want, between the Russian understanding of the internet and the Western understanding of the internet. For the West, the internet was all about possibilities and the new ideas and options which you can exploit and you can use to advance your society. For the Russians, it was all about threats, which is understandable because we had people from the KGB defining the policy about the internet. And that was reflected on the language we used. In the West, it was always about cybersecurity, cyber warfare, meaning computers and cables. In Russia, the terminology was different. It was always about information security, information warfare, information threats. Why is that? Because Russians were mostly concerned not with cables and computers, but with the content, with the message. And they believed that the same journalists who undermined the Russian war effort in Chechnya in the 1990s, now they might use a new space, the internet, to undermine or subvert Russian political stability. And they got crazy about that, and they always insisted on using information security as a terminology. What happened after 2016 is that the West, because we got actually frightened by what happened with the Russian interference, lots of Western experts, cyber experts, called me and said, look, Andrei, well, probably the Russians were right. Actually, we need to talk not only about cyber, but we need to talk about information security, because we need to do something about our content. Maybe we need some sort of patrolling of social media, not censorship, but something close. And to be honest, if you look at what's going on in Europe in terms of all this regulation against social media, well, it's getting very close to censorship. Yes, it's not, I would say, political. It's not about one party saying the rest of the country what we should think, but it's about the way how we need to think and what is considered to be appropriate and what is not. And we are getting more and more censors in this global social media. And to be honest, well, it's exactly what the Russians were thinking about. That's exactly what we wanted to achieve. We wanted everybody else to start thinking and talking while using their terminology, living in their world.
So that brings us back to the home turf for Vladimir Putin, for the Kremlin, the domestic audience. And the effort that you described certainly is affecting us in the West, but it begins at home. Can you talk a bit about what has happened to the media environment within Russia, where you were until recently? What are the new challenges your colleagues who are still there, what do they face? And what about the idea of what Vladimir Putin has called a sovereign internet? Is this a viable thing? And how will it change things for them if it really gains traction?
Well, I'd say that right now, this year is probably a crucial year for the Russian internet and for the Russian media. The Russian authorities and the Kremlin started this big offensive on internet freedoms and media freedoms many years ago. And they had some successes and they had some problems, but this road was really bumpy for them. But what we are getting at now is much more dangerous. And to be honest, they are getting much more competent in what they are doing. It goes, it's very true for what they are doing about journalists. They encourage people to leave the country and they use all methods available from direct intimidation, and that's something which happened to me, to criminal investigations, accusations ranging from infringement of privacy of higher level officials to branding people as foreign agents or people working for undesirable organizations. There's lots of possible consequences, I mean, including criminal prosecution. And sometimes they just tell you that it's time to leave the country. They also attack the media as entities. They strip them of licenses. They brand them as foreign agents. And it's absolutely unprecedented, to be honest. Almost every independent media we still had in the country got attacked this year. And I would say it started last year when we got the very first journalist being accused of state treason. And that never happened before, well, almost never happened before, because it was impossible, basically on legal grounds. You cannot accuse somebody who has no access to secrets to be a spy. Now it became possible. Now they changed the law dramatically, and they can accuse a journalist of, quote, harming national interest because he or she talks to an international organization about something. And that could be anything. It might be a story published in the New York Times and the journalist just gave him his comment on the information or insight. That would be enough for a prosecution. So that's what is going on with the media. With the internet, it's even more drastic. Yes, you're right, mentioning the sovereign internet, and it's unfortunately, it's achievable. And what it's about is about a new kind of equipment, which the government installed all across the country. And this equipment is based on a paradoxically Western technology called DPI, Deep Packet Inspection. And it's extremely good at filtering traffic, at suppressing particular kinds of traffic. And maybe you remember that this spring, we got this big scandal with slowing down Twitter. And that was done using this equipment, these technologies. And now they are thinking that they can attack more, and they are attacking VPNs as a way, actually the technology which help you to bypass censorship. They attack global platforms, they attack YouTube. So it's quite a, I would say, it's very systematic. And it's strategic, and unfortunately, in a few months we can get the country with people, and the country is actually is hugely and highly digitized. But we can get the population of the country getting used to live in a bubble of Russian-made applications, Russian-made technologies, Russian-made platforms.
Your most recent book, which you also wrote with your co-author Irina, is called The Compatriots, and it's all about the history of Russia's exiles and emigres outside of the country throughout the last 100 years. It's not a secret that Vladimir Putin sees these people as an essential part of the Ruski Mir, of the Russian world, and has consistently tried to reach out to them. How has he tried to do that in terms of broadcasting and public diplomacy? And what's the message that he's trying to send to them?
Well, it's quite interesting because it's not only about, say, achieving some goals abroad. It's also about the people in the country. And what we need to remember, people like Putin, they're always obsessed with threats to their political stability, as they call it. And for many years, lots of people in the Soviet Union and in New Russia believed people in the security services that the Russians abroad might pose some threat. If not an immediate threat, like spies or subversive elements, but also as an idea, as a concept of some other Russia, not corrupted by, say, cooperation with communists and KGB. And actually, it was quite a big idea and very popular idea. I remember my parents talking about people living in, say, France being uncorrupted by communists. And there was a big respect in the Russian society, back when the Soviet society, to these people. And there was an idea that, well, which sounds quite strange today, that most of these immigrants were much higher educated. They saved the proper Russian language, not corrupted by Bolsheviks and all that. It was a very naive idea, but extremely popular. The Kremlin and Putin personally didn't like this idea. He wants to have only one Russia, and this Russia should be in the country. So he made a big effort attacking ideological concepts of the other Russia abroad. And he started with the church, because there was a big idea in the 1990s that, well, at least the church abroad is not corrupted by communists, so we need to invite these people over to the country and to restart the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia. And so these people were in direct competition with the church, which stayed in the country under Bolsheviks. Putin attacked this church, and actually he made a personal contribution and personal effort to make this church, the Russian Orthodox Church abroad, to join in with the Moscow Church, so-called Red Church. And now we have one church directed from Moscow under control of the government. Putin also attacked the idea of the Russian elites, which might live somewhere, not in the country, and thus presenting some sort of threat. And the idea of these elites for him was reflected in the Russian aristocracy. So he started talking with descendants of Russian aristocrats living in Europe or in the United States, inviting them, recruiting them, trying to find some attraction for them to get back to the country, or at least to show the loyalty and respect to what was going on in the country. And again, it was extremely successful. And given these examples, I would say that the effort was at least partly successful. And of course, we also need to remember about ordinary people who left the country, but they have these problems and they are struggling with a national identity. And when people do not know what to think about themselves, whether they are new Americans or they are new Europeans or they are still Russians and they are divided inside, they are easy target, to be honest, for propaganda. If somebody from the countries saying and sending this message to them that there is a big country, quite imperial in design and ambitions, and you are part of this big community. You are not left alone. Lots of people got this message and now support it.
To finish up, I wanted to go back to the beginning. We here in the West tend to see Russia as an aggressive information actor, and it definitely is. But the Russian government also sees itself under a sort of informational assault from the West. What's the danger that it sees from the United States and from Europe in those terms? What is it trying to respond to?
Well, I think we all this need to remember how difficult it was for new Russia to catch up with the West in technology. Yes, the Soviet Union was a very powerful state with a very big army, but technologically speaking, there was a big problem. There were problems, you have computers, we have telecommunication technologies, and for a reason, to be honest, because the country and the government was not interested at developing telecommunication technologies for the population. We reported that in our book, The Red Web, that there was a discussion in the Soviet government back in the 1960s. They had some limited capacities, some limited funding, and they needed to understand where they need to invest their money, whether to give phone numbers to the ordinary Russians or to give his capacities to the industry. And they decided that the ordinary Russians, well, they could survive without a phone connection. They don't need it. They decided to give, I mean, the government decided to give everything to the industry. And while we got the consequences of this choice, and to be honest, the KGB also supported this idea. They believed that there is some danger, a substantial existential danger in telecommunications. Again, in our book, we have an example of the country reading itself to the Olympic Games of 1980 in Moscow, and how the Ministry of Communications made a huge effort at building up a brand new telecommunication station in Moscow to make it possible an automatic connection because it was one of the requirements of the Olympic Committee. And they did that. But what happened next? In 6 months, the KGB came to the Ministry of Communications and said, look, you need to disconnect that because these lines might be used by dissidents, by troublemakers, by spies, by I don't know what. And that's exactly what happened. And what happened next in the 1990s was what we got this new country, capitalist country, and for businesses, for all these people who became much more active than back in the Soviet Union, these people needed new communications. And the Minister of Communications, his name was Vladimir Bulgak. He was a smart guy, quite ruthless. And he understood that if you want to make it happen to build new communications, he couldn't rely on Russian-made technologies. So he just threw away all these old Soviet factories and bought everything in the United States. And in this way, the Russian internet was built on American technologies, mostly on Cisco. And of course, it created such a huge paranoia in the Russian security services. Imagine it, like you have these generals sitting in their offices on Lubyanka, thinking that everything they use these days, phone numbers, phone communications, internet, social media, everything goes through the American equipment. It was a very unsettling thought for these people already in the 1990s. But with Putin, well, Putin understood that concern. But still, he had no time and he didn't believe back then that it would be such a huge problem. But in the late 2010s, he understood it is a problem. So now we are having this new drive to replace everything, I mean, in Russian internet infrastructure with something made in the country. And the Russian security services, they got so paranoid that they are happy to get rid of American technologies, but they are not happy to buy anywhere, including China. So all these concerns that like Russia and China might start to work together and telecommunications, it's not actually that justifiable, not actually that true right now, because again, the FSB is too suspicious and too paranoid. In the end of the day, it's all about information control. The idea, which is very close to the hearts of the people in the Kremlin and people in the FSB, and sometimes it's exactly the same people. And unfortunately, now we are coming to a point when the Russian information security doctrine states it very clearly that security of the country, meaning security of a political regime, means more than development of the society and development of technologies and the development of economy of the country.
So I have to ask, where do you think this informational contest between Russia and the West is going? It's very clear from the way you've described it that Russia feels like it's locked in a battle of ideas with the West, and it's arming itself with the tools to compete. And in the West, we're only beginning to become aware of this contest. Where do you see this heading?
These days, I'm getting more pessimistic. 5 years ago, I would say, well, of course, we would lose because, well, it's absolutely incomparable with what we had back in the time of the Cold War. Back then, the Kremlin had at least one big idea. Communism was a very interesting concept, appealing to so many people all over the globe. And now, clearly, Putin doesn't have such a big and an appealing idea, but he has something more important. He represents this very dark view on everything. And he's extremely suspicious. And it's part of the mentality of the KGB. All the suspect normal people of being very bad inside. People like Putin, they seize everything in terms of threats, like every new development, like technological, or if you have some new movement in the society, people like Putin always think, well, does it pose some threat to me and my political stability? That's the way they think. And my problem now is that idea of seeing everything as a potential threat is actually invading the society in the West. Look how we started talking about the internet these days. We are not talking about new opportunities it gives us. That, like, long gone, and we probably, last time we had this kind of conversation back in the early 2000s. Now it's all about threats. We have problems with that or this, we have terrorists, we have extremists, we have Islamists, all of them doing something online, which again constitutes some threat to our society, to our values and all that. This is exactly the world people like Putin live and know how to exploit. And this is my problem. So we do not have this battle of big ideas like we had 70 years ago, but we have this battle between the universal concept that something might be actually for good, like environmentalists or some movements, some new political ideas, and a dark idea that actually people do something publicly only because they are corrupt, they're bad, they are paid by some agents or they are spies. And I, to be honest, I just don't know what's going to happen next and who might win this battle.
Andre, thanks so much for a tremendous conversation. This has been a real peek behind the curtain in terms of how the Russian government operates and how the Russian government thinks about the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.